from KMUW Wichita,
from Toronto, Ontario,
and from Armilla, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk the oldest of English words and look at how little some of them have changed over thousands of years. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me, as they do, of course, every week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors Kathy Petrus and Ross Petrus. Ross Petrus, hello. You're in Toronto at your home. Ross, I remember sometime back you said that pretty much every weekend in Toronto there's some kind of festival going on or some kind of march. It's basically mid-June now, so what's the big mid-June Toronto festival?
Fletcher, I had not noticed one because I was at Lake Erie at a friend's cottage, which I'm not sure I mentioned. He had like a little cottage. He said, "Why don't you come to my cottage?" So we thought like it'd be a little, we had a picture of a little, you know, cute little cottage, and it was like a multi-million dollar mansion right on the water.
Wow. I know. Kathy Petrus, hello. You're in Armilla. Hopefully recently relaxing on your brand new couch.
That's right. We did get that IKEA replacement. And it's the Ektorp this time, which is, as the guy who put it together told me, was mas mejor. So I'm very happy. We're very happy. We're sitting on that couch. We're watching our new TV. We bought a new TV to celebrate. So life is great.
Yeah, and I'm starting to think that maybe IKEA needs to start giving us some money because
really, they're getting a free. They also gave me a little gift card. So I love them. I'll plug them for anything. I'm very easy.
A couple of weeks ago, we talked fossil words, old words that don't necessarily mean what they used to. Now we're talking about even older words. We're talking about some of the oldest words in the English language.
Okay. Kath, you want to start with your...
I'm sorry. We have one email I just wanted to answer. It's something that I talked about with Ross, and Ross said he'd never heard this. It was a Dale in Minneapolis who said, "My husband always says, 'I'll come with,' or 'Do you want to go with?'" Mm. Is it correct? Ross had never, you've never heard it, Ross, right?
I probably have. I never noticed it.
What about you, Fletcher? Have you heard that? Like, you know, yeah, I'll go with.
Yeah, so it's funny that Dale is from Minneapolis. The first time I remember hearing this, I think, was when I saw the movie Fargo. So back in 1996
right.
is when that came out. And I guess from the Great Plains, we also call ourselves from the Midwest, but it's certainly not the upper Midwest, like Minnesota is. And so I wonder if that is a particularly upper Midwest phrase.
It is. That's because I looked it up because now I say it oddly enough. And I mean, I grew up in New Jersey and lived in New York all my life before I came here. Well, there was also Seattle, but that's beside the point. I mean, I've heard it a lot. And maybe it's in New York you heard it because people were from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's actually an upper Midwest dialect. They think it's via Scandinavia, and which would explain Minnesota in particular. And now I'm really hearing Fargo in my head.
Yeah.
I'm hearing her voice. I really am.
That's what I heard.
But yeah, it's a regional construct, and it's not incorrect. It's just not, it's not really widespread, but I think it is more, and I'm wondering if Fargo spread it.
Yeah,
now.
That's
I've
what
been
I'm
trying
wondering.
To listen to it.
Yeah.
I've been trying to hear it now. I haven't heard it, but I'm listening.
As I said, I say it now sometimes. I'll go, "Do you want to come with?" I'll do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very not me. I mean, I certainly am not from Minnesota, which is a fine place, but but it's fine. So Dale, don't worry. Like your husband's like, you know, normal, I think. But
it makes me wonder, you know, obviously we don't know where Dale comes from or where Dale's husband comes from, but I wonder if Dale's husband is from that area and Dale is not.
And that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I suspect. But anyway, now I want to start hearing, because although now you want to come with, to me it sounds very homey. It sounds like really pleasant. It's sort of, hey, yeah, want to come with? Sure.
It's sort of like the German, too, mitkommen, I guess, because that would be the same thing, come with.
Yeah.
Which would probably be the Scandinavian, too. I don't know the Scandinavian, but yeah, that makes sense.
Dale, there's your answer. Husband, fine. Fine. And let's move on.
Move on to the oldest words. The oldest words.
Okay. Yeah. Here the idea, Fletcher, is these are words that basically don't seem to have changed that significantly in sound going all the way back 10, 15,000 years ago. Basically, the idea is 9,000. The idea basically is you could go back into time where the earliest precursor or the very early precursors of English and various other languages and basically be understood if you said these various words. They're not, as you'll see, they're not amazingly useful for certain things, but these are...
it depends on your friends,
depends on what's going on. But these are basically what happened. These are what we'd call Proto-Eurasiatic words. This is a giant superfamily that gave birth to seven other language families, including English and other Indo-European languages. Other languages like Turkish, Uzbek, Mongolian, stretching all the way across to Siberia, south to India, and literally across into the upper parts of Americas, Inuit, etc.
It's like the amazings of language, if you will. Yes. The amazing family.
And Kath, do you want to explain what they did? Because this is sort of interesting what they did, how they figured this out.
They did a study at the University of Reading, and they wanted to find the deep relationships to see how words evolved and which seemed to be the, I have to find the study here.
It was ultra-conserved words. These are words, like we said, that started out in this proto-Euro-Asiatic language and that pretty much stayed the same. The sound changes, there are normal sound changes in languages, and these pretty much stayed the same. We also switch meanings completely. You know, this word used to mean this, and now everyone forgets that, and a new word comes into being. These are words that are just stayed the same over those thousands of years.
Most words evolve too quickly. We always talk about how words change, and we were talking about that recently when you look at, like, woman or whatever. Usually you can't prove ancestry because they've changed so dramatically and so quickly. After about, it sounds so long, but 5,000 to 9,000 years.
No, actually, though, a lot of times you can prove ancestry, but they've changed so much that it's hard to, like, Kyklos and wheel are related, but it's really hard to, like, figure out that you have to do statistical studies and know about sound changes to figure it out.
Yeah, and that these are words that were ultra-conserved, as Ross said, that, like, beyond that, like, mere 9,000 years, we can see the relationships.
We can not only see the relationship, we can hear it. I think that's the key, Kathy. The key thing is, because the word, like I said, with Kyklos and wheel, we can see that they're related. But if I go, like, Fletcher, could you hand me that Kyklos? He might get it. He might go, oh, cycle must mean wheel. But he wouldn't be that sure. These are words that you'd be pretty sure you'd understand 10,000 years ago on the steppes of Central Asia, and you'd understand now. That's the key.
And kind of crazy to think about. I mean, you know, we see time travel movies or movies, there are a few of them set 10,000 years ago or whatever, and we sort of try to imagine ourselves trying to communicate with people then, and it doesn't really work. But there are some words that would, like, make sense to either party, us now or people 10,000 years ago. And that's pretty wild to think about.
Yeah, that got me as a kid because there's this book on the Hittites, the ancient Hittites who were in Anatolia like thousands and thousands of years ago. And it flipped me out because the word to eat in Hittite was Essen, which is the word to eat in German. And it sort of flipped me that I could, like, because I knew that German word, I could go back to, like, Anatolia with these guys, you know, fighting the pharaohs, and they'd understand if I was hungry, I could go Essen. They'd sort of get the idea, you know.
Although, wouldn't it be easier just to mime eating? I'm going the low tech way.
That's a really good point, Kathy. My 8-year-old Ross is now thinking, gee, Kathy's right. I should have asked her that thing.
Ross, you should have listened to your sister.
I know.
So we've set this up in groups of three.
Okay.
And we're asking you, which do you think is the oldest?
Okay, which of the three words in each set is the oldest of those words?
Ready?
Okay, so Kathy sent me this first list of words here. These three words, and I think you've started me off actually with one that's going to be really easy for me because I remember a conversation the three of us had a while back. So the first three words here. Worm, dog, and lizard. All good choices, but I do remember the two of you saying that worm is one of the oldest words that we have, like that has stayed relatively the same. It's one of the very, very oldest.
You're completely correct. It's one of the first, it's an ultra conserved word. It goes all the way back to ancient times and prehistoric times. You could say worm on those plains 10,000 years ago and they'd know what you're talking about to some degree. Because with them, worm also meant snakes, other creepy crawly creatures as well.
Yeah, anything that's crawling around that maybe you'll want to stay away from.
Right. And interestingly enough, I mean, the were part actually forms lots of words that we know today, including things like your anniversary. You can think about a worm then.
What?
Well, the ver part in anniversary comes from the Proto-Indo-European were, which is the turning, and the were and the annus is year, so turning of the year.
Oh, wow.
So it's the slithering of the year, sort of.
Slithering of the year.
Isn't it kind of like the slithering of a year then?
Well, it's the turning, because the word is basically to turn. Yeah, to turn.
Yeah, but I'm saying it came from the snake slithering and serpentining, no?
Slightly, but snaka comes from more the creepy. Because the interesting thing is, gradually in English, a worm was for snake was changed to snaka, which is another early word. Meaning creeping. But the thing that really got me the most was with ultra-conserved words, most of the time, and this is a clue Fletcher's going to get for the next parts, they're pretty much common words that you basically figure, like we didn't do it, but mom, you know, mother, that's an ancient word. And it's one of the first things you see and all of that. So why would worm go? And then they start looking it up and you think about it, and there's some guy who did some scientist, it's probably wacky, but had the idea that worms, in effect, helped pass along human intelligence, because like your baby is on the ground in like some plane and sees a snake or sees a bug, which worm also meant, and screams. So the people that saw these dangerous slithery things as kids screamed out and they passed on their genes because they lived. Whereas the guy who's like, oh, just a worm, he got killed. And like a big predator, like a lion, your parents take care of. The worm, like you may, your mom may not see the snake coming up or something like that. That's one theory. And then this other really wacky scientists did studies. I have no idea what parent would let your kid go through this. They did put babies in a room and they like flashed or like little videos of like lions, tigers and stuff. And the babies were pretty calm. When they saw snakes, they flipped out.
Oh, wow.
So, wow, that's interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Well, we should quickly say, though, what about the other words? Mm-hmm. Lizard, I like, because it's one definition was an animal resembling a serpent. Here we go back to snake, with legs added to it. And do you remember we talked about musculus a while back?
Oh, the muscle comes from little mouse? Yeah.
It's similar to that. Lizard came from a similar background. Ross, you can go, because it's Latin.
Oh, it would be lacertum. For upper arm, the muscular part of the arm. And that's, they think lizard may have come from that. They're not sure, though.
Hmm.
And dog?
Well, dog is interesting because dog, they don't really know where it came from. It's a late, very rare word, and they think it originally meant a very powerful type of, quote, I'm going to use a word here, canine. And canine is interesting because it shows, again, how old English, how old Proto-Indo-European and before that change. Because canine is related to hound, believe it or not. And the sound changes. But Kathy might ask us, I'm going to ask Kathy a question now. What's the word for dog in Spanish, Kathy?
Perro.
And what's that related to?
I have no idea.
No one does. And that's the really interesting thing about ultra-conserved words. We're talking earlier about very common words have more of a tendency to say the same. And yet we have dog, which has been a companion of humans for thousands and thousands of years. Yet the word is different. Perro. Pero, hound, doca, they're all different. Why did that happen and why did worms stick? No idea.
I just want to say also, though, regarding dog, I'm just looking at it now, how many meanings dog applied to humans has. You have dog as an ugly woman, starting in the 30s. Dog is a sexually aggressive man from the 50s. Dog is in who? He's a gallant. He's a sport from the 1610s. So dog is a play. Oh, and then 1200, they used dog as a currish, sneaking scoundrel. So dog was also applied across the board. But I'm a cat person, so never mind.
Okay, next set of words. Whoa. Okay, some things we're doing with our mouths. First word is yawn. Second word is wretch. And third word is spit. Yawn, wretch, and spit. Of those three, my gut tells me. Should I now? Should I go with my gut? I want to say spit.
You're right.
The other two seemed slightly more high concept to me.
For monosyllabic words, they are indeed.
which of those three is the most like basic? I mean, spitting, yawning is kind of a complex thing because we aren't 100% sure why we're doing it anyway. You know, it does it have social implications and that sort of thing? And then wretch, I'm just telling you my thought process here. I'm not explaining anything.
No, it's a good thought process. And we go back to the problems with doing this analysis even is that yawn is, I think, fairly clearly related to a very early word because they're trying to reconstruct what it sounded like, uh-huh. What Proto-Indo-European sounded like. And there's like a star G-H-I-E-H. And now the question is, what does a star G-H sound like? I can go through a long A, but the basic idea is kind of yeah, uh-huh. Which is pretty close.
Okay.
Yeah. Something like
well,
that.
Well, think about it, because really it's onomatopoeia, really, when you think, because I never really think about it, but yawn sounds like what
yawn.
Yeah. It sounds exactly like what you're doing. Yeah. It just made me want to yawn, actually, when I did that. Seriously.
Mm. Yeah. I yawned it, actually, yeah.
And wretch is pretty good, close, too. Proto-Germanic.
Although wretch is not, wretch comes from Proto-Germanic. Wretch, though, I can't pronounce the star, K-H-R, that connected A-E.
But I think the sound, again, goes back to the early, you know, the Proto-Asiatic, Proto-Indo-European sounds as well. Because it's sort of onomatopoeic as well. So here we go again. We're really
wretch.
Doing...
I'm trying it. Wretch.
And so what we're doing is we're saying which is the closest. And these other two are pretty good contenders. But spew it is closer. That's the whole thing. Okay, moving right along.
All right.
Fletcher?
This is a fun one.
This is interesting because of these three words, one seems the obvious choice. And so I'm not sure that it actually is. The three words are salmon, like the fish or the color, I guess. Lox, L-O-X, like salmon that you eat. And fish, fish, F-I-S-H. Well, you would expect that just basic fish is the answer here. Maybe it's not. Maybe I'll choose salmon. How about salmon?
No.
Okay.
Well, it is a type of salmon.
Okay. Lox is the...
Yep.
Wow. Lox.
Isn't that flippy?
L-O-X is the oldest of these three words. That's wild.
Yep. And you go back to those plains 10,000 years ago and you go, I'll have a lox with a schmear.
They'll give you half of that.
Right. They might have had schmears.
I think that's really cool.
Isn't it?
All right. You got to explain this one to me.
Well, basically, the interesting thing with this really is that we can determine that the early Proto-Indo-European or Proto-Asiatic, you know, the grandfather of a grandmother, whatever, of those languages were on the plains where there were fish called salmon. And that's what they were eating. The interesting thing with lox is it changed gradually into the meaning we know today. But we can see that they were not seafaring people. They were people who lived far from the ocean. But this is like interesting because this did not form in that University of Reading study. They did not mention this.
Mm-mm.
They mentioned other words like this, but this is the one that we can really is interesting again, though, because we see the importance of this word. Obviously, they were people who frequently did a lot of fishing.
Did it refer to specifically the salmon?
Salmon. Well, the thing that's so weird, and it was always pronounced. This is the one that I think more than most of the others where you make a little stretch. It really is pronounced similarly from what they've discovered,
wow.
From what they're seeing and tracing it. It's spelled differently. Like they talk about different species of the Indo-European languages. And okay, you've got and one type fish salmon is L-A-K-S, which is similar to the German L-A-C-H-S and Icelandic L-A-X. They all share Proto-Indo-European. Czech, Croatian, Macedonian, Latvian, they change it to an S and it's losos, but it's always this one syllable thing. Mm-hmm. And I loved, Ross, do you have it? There was a linguistics professor who had a quote about lox. Oh, here it is. The pronunciation in Proto-Indo-European was probably lox. And that's exactly how it's pronounced in modern English. Then it meant salmon. Now it specifically means smoked salmon. But still, it's lox. Like
it's still really good. Yeah.
You go there with your bagel, they'll give it to you.
Yeah,
you
it's really cool. That one really interested me, I think. And again, though, it goes back to, it's sort of interesting because we have certain words that like you would predict would have been with us all along, like dog. But I wouldn't have predicted lox being
lox.
No.
Yeah.
I wouldn't at all. And apparently it does mean specifically salmon. I mean, it's not other types of fish, which is really cool, too. Fish, though, is a little more fish, though, interestingly enough, we're going back to how changes occur. And, like, you know, we're kind of stretching things a little bit because they think that fish may have come back from a Proto-Indo-European root that's probably sounded something like pisk, fish.
Oh, interesting.
So it'd
well,
be close
then you've
enough.
Got like your piscine or piscatarian. Pescatarian. Yeah.
So it's still pretty good there, too. I mean, we could go pisk and chips, and they might give us a little bit of fish and chips. They might think, that sounds sort of like pisk, so we'll give it to them. Well, Fletcher, now we're talking about dogs, but this time we're...
Ross, that's very clever.
We have tree, bark, and twig.
Tree, bark, and twig. And I'm going to assume in this case we're talking bark related to the wood on a tree, the outside of the tree, rather than the sound the dog makes.
That's supposed to woo, woo. Yeah.
Right. Well, see, in this case, of course, you sort of figure it's got to be tree because that's like the root of the other two. You're not getting your twigs and bark without the tree. But let's go with twig. I want to go with twig.
That's wrong. And it's so interesting because I would have guessed exactly like you did. And we go back to the whole thing with words being picked up like salmon. Twig apparently came from a Proto-Germanic, which probably goes right back to obviously goes back even further, to twiga, which is a fork.
Oh,
because, you know, twigs branch out. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it is cool. Yeah.
Kathy, do you want to tell him the real one or not?
Okay, I'm going to ask him. Okay, now we're down to bark and twig. I mean, bark and tree.
Right. Because I was starting to talk myself into tree, I'm going to go with bark.
Very good move. You win the Spidell watch band. Yes. Yes, bark. Which I wouldn't have thought. When I first looked at the list, it's interesting, Ross, that you made the humorous segue from the dog. Because when I first looked at the list of the words from the Red, this is another from the Redding study. I thought bark as in dog, because I thought, you know, predatory wolves or whatever, you know, rawr, rawr. Mm-hmm. But it's, then when you think about it, tree skin makes more sense, doesn't it? Or does it? I don't know.
The question I had is it shows how far removed we are from our ancestors. Because bark, like Kathy said, I had the same thing with bark, you know, dogs barking around the campfire as you're trying to ward off wolves or something. I had the same feeling she did. But bark was important in ancient times. I mean, they used it, you know, to...
Medicinally,
they used it to make stuff, you know, to make... Now we show our Proto-Indo-European knowledge here.
Yeah, you don't know what day-to-day life was back then?
Well, I know one thing. They talked about bark a lot.
Apparently. It's funny because they did say in the study that, you know, you really bark is not one of those words that you use often. I rarely speak of tree bark. I mean, maybe it's me, but it was conserved. It's an ultra conserved word, which is very strange to me.
You know, you'd use it to like you'd peel off bark when you made, fires. You'd use bark maybe for, you know, dying things.
Canoes or stuff.
Kathy's canoes to go catch lox. Yeah. Bark canoes. Yeah. No, I mean.
You might take some off the tree to smack a worm.
There you go. Yeah. But that was the whole interesting thing about this whole Indo-European thing. Let's give Fletcher the whole list now. They had picked 23 ultra-conserved words. they're like mixed. I mean, you have common ones and then not so common ones, like bark. These are the 23 other, there were 24. We had worm, we had thou, I, not, that, we, to give, who, this, what, man, male, ye, old, mother, to hear, hand, fire, to pull, black, to flow, and bark, and ashes, and to spit.
Hearing all of those words, I don't know, it's kind of evocative of, you know, a certain time and place. I mean, like, those, they're so basic,
I know.
In terms of immediate needs and like what are the things you really need to talk about?
I get this. I could go like, give I, and they didn't, this is a different word from a different list, but give I locks, you know, they'd get it. That's really cool.
But also, this sounds really nuts, and I don't mean it to sound that way. Do you get this sort of weird, like you're outside and there's a big sky feeling when you hear this list?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, isn't it? Like, it's kind of like you said, Fletcher, very evocative, because I do feel that sort of small person, big world, fire, mother.
But the other interesting thing, we've said this before, though, is that discrepancy between certain words, which we automatically would expect. If you had to ask me, you know, which words would be on there, I would have picked mother, you know, all of the give, that fire, I would have guessed. But then the weird words is interesting as well. We don't quite understand why they're on that list. But basically, we're talking about 14,000 years ago. Wow. These words pretty much sound the same. And the frequency thing was interesting, too. Words that were used more than once per thousand words in everyday speech were much more likely to show deep ancestry.
Because that's what I was just going to say. When you think, I mean, mother, obvious. I mean, mother, you always think of. But what got me were the words like not or that or we or this. Mm-hmm. And then you think, of course, like also because you had them, why would you make something else up for them?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's too complicated, I think, once you've already used them for that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's really, it's a very, I mean, this is just the very beginning of it, though. Some people are actually saying this is a little bit overdone. But I think this is going to be, I think we're going to start getting into some really interesting finds pretty soon. The key question now is, these are languages that don't include African languages and don't include the Semitic languages like Arabic and Hebrew, you know, or ancient Egyptian or Hamitic languages, etc. And they don't include Chinese or the Sinitic language, the Chinese languages. So I'd like to see what's going to happen, because there could be a super family that includes those languages as well.
That starts from the very top, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm really curious about that.
Do you think there would be? I mean, well, there. I don't know. I go back and forth on that one, if you think there would be or not. Because you've got like these disparate groups, but then presumably we all started here and then spread.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a toughie. I wonder if, I don't know if I believe there will be or not, but I'd like it.
I'd like to see it.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can find all of their books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.